You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers, and Bennett Van Praagh. You're back.
I'm back.
Nice to have a co-host again. And the reason for your absence is actually quite obvious when I look at your stomach. Would you want to explain?
Yes, I am pregnant and have been afflicted with the same thing that the princess was afflicted with, which is some
The Duchess
hideous.
Of Cambridge.
The Duchess of Cambridge, indeed. Wow, so I'm in good company, but I didn't enjoy it.
Did you have to cancel all your public engagements?
I had to cancel everything, yeah.
Well, it's nice to have you back.
It's lovely to be back. I am. I'm 4 months now, and apparently that's when things get easier again.
Excellent. So baby's due?
Baby's due September.
Lovely. Yeah. Late summer baby. Okay, yes, you're listening to Bookmark. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. We've got interviews today with debut novelist Janet Todd and curator of books at the Fitzwilliam Museum, Edward Cheese. And our studio guest is poet Rod Mangham. Hello, Rod.
Hi.
Hello, poet.
Hello, presenter.
We're talking to Jan Todd later, say debut novelist. Can you remember, Rod, the first time you saw your work in print?
I think I put it in print. Myself, when I was a student with a couple of other students, we got together a magazine called Mineral Waters of the Caucasus.
Oh, wonderful.
Which is the title of a film by Lev Kuleshov, who was the inventor of montage. And you could say that a lot of this work followed the principle of montage.
Right. And how did it feel to see it in print?
It was a relief. Because in those days, there was no easy way of printing things. And we typed everything up on a typewriter with duplicator paper, which meant that if there was a mistake, there was a mistake. And you had to start again. No Tippex would have worked. So we delivered this rather blotchy copy to the printers. There used to be lots of print shops in King Street in those days. This was when I was a student, by the way.
So, yes, you say in those days. What year are we talking here?
That was 76, if I'm remembering correctly.
And does the thrill ever wear off of seeing your words in print?
Absolutely not, no. The work itself involves quite a long process of mulling over and composition, and the reading of it and the presentation of it as an object is all part of the same process.
And is there something about seeing it on the page as well, rather than see it, because you can see it on a screen? Is it something about having a written book in your hand?
I'm somebody who's a complete addict of the book as an object. I need to have the physical object. And definitely the book presents, that has a kind of sculptural element to it. And the screen just doesn't do that for me.
Well, we're going to come back to sculpture as well, actually, because I know that's a big love of yours. But we'll listen to your first track of music now. Now, this is Sibelius Symphony No. 3. Why have you chosen this piece?
Well, this goes all the way back to when I first started getting interested in music, paying attention to music and being switched on by it. And Sibelius, of course, is the composer of Finland. And there's a real attachment to his native land, which is, I think, pretty apparent immediately when you listen to his music. And although his attachment to Finland is a nationalist attachment, and I'm not interested in that, and I have no connection with Finland, it's music which somehow expresses a landscape, and that's what I found particularly compelling.
That was Sibelius Symphony No. 3, the first choice of music of our studio guest today on Bookmark, Rod Mangham. Rod is reader in modern English at Jesus College, Cambridge, and curator of the sculpture exhibitions there. He edits the Equipage series of poetry pamphlets, and his own poetry collections, Unsung and Chance of a Storm, have been published by Salt and Carcanet, respectively. He's also edited and written books on Charles Dickens, Thomas Hardy, Emily Bronte, and Henry Green. So welcome again, Rod. I suppose the obvious question to a poet is, when did you feel you were a poet? When did you feel drawn to poetry?
quite early on when I was at school. And of course, in those days, I went to school in the 19th century, and poetry was an important part of the everyday fare. And it wasn't taught as such. We weren't taught how to write poetry, and didn't really analyse it either, but there was a lot of reading of poetry. And one teacher in particular, called Frank Whitbourne, who was a thesp, serious thesp, wrote quite a lot of one-act plays and had them published, had a fantastic speaking voice. And Frank reading Shakespeare, reading Edmund Spenser, reading Milton, was a captivating experience, actually. So you really got a sense of how these constructs worked or ought to work.
I mean, it's a bit different now when they teach poetry because they drill down into it more. Was it more the sound of the words then that attracted you rather than the ideas that were being expressed or the form?
I suspect it was the sound to begin with, the musicality, and music is still very important to me, believe it or not, I don't know if you've read any of my poems, but that has to do with form anyway, a sense of a thing having a definite shape and a definite structure. Particularly if you're writing free verse, you have to find your own shape, your own structure, or every poem has to find its own shape and structure.
And was there one particular poet that stood out for you that made you think this might be something that I want to do or inspired you in some way?
I think I saw an example of how you might go about putting together work in what seemed to me a completely fresh and, you know, original way. When I was in the sixth form and reading poetry of Ezra Pound, whose ideas, of course, are very complicated and politically poisoned, as became apparent to me in course of time, but also had, was filled with moments of extreme beauty and managed to connect together different kinds of language from different periods of history and, mould them together, fuse them together in the most convincing fashion.
So it was the modernist poetry that attracted you more than, you mentioned Milton and Spenser.
Yes, I mean, they were kind of a fantastic model to have in your mind and in your memory and in your oral memory. But they weren't for this time. And I was looking for something that made sense of the world around me, was a container for thoughts and feelings about the world around me at the time.
But a kind of shorter, a smaller container, if you like. I know you can get big ideas in this small container, but it was that rather than fiction or prose that attracted you. I'm wondering why that denser, punchier form in particular.
Well, I find prose equally absorbing. And in fact, quite a half of the texts in the most recent book, Chance of a Storm, are prose. But they're prose poems. So whether you're thinking about verse form or prose form, it's concentration, I suppose, that really has to be there for me.
And can you say anything in poetry? I mean, is there any subject that's off bounds for you, or would you use a poem to say anything?
No, I think that's the point. You know, if you ask me what my poetry is about, it's whatever comes along. There are no boundaries. Because it's me, certain things tend to recur. But I don't think anything is off bounds.
And I've got a quote from you, which I'm going to fire, but people always look at me blankly when I fire quotes to them because many of them were attributed to them, but they didn't say them. But I believe you said, "Poems should be finished but be still hot to the touch, giving a vivid sense of the thinking and feeling that went into their creation." What do you mean by that?
Well, yeah, it's words that come back to haunt you.
Yes, sorry.
No, that's absolutely fine. What I'm trying to sort of convey there is the sense that a poem shouldn't be simply a statement of fact. It should convey something of the mix of thought and feeling that is in play when you're writing a poem. And also give the reader some sense of how differently it might have turned out, because it's trying to hold together lots of different ideas and different trains of thought. And therefore, it needs a kind of mobility about it.
So how do you do that? Because other than giving the first draft, then the second draft, then the third, and showing the possibilities of what it could be, you're using words to suggest different directions it might have gone.
Yeah. Well, sometimes I think the words suggest, not the words, but the constructions, phrases, sentences, the use of rhyme or half rhyme might suggest that there is more than one meaning in play here, and that halfway through a sentence, the whole direction of the sentence can change. And so you seem to be folding together two separate or divergent lots of meaning. That all sounds very abstract, of course.
Now, I'm just imagining lying awake at night fretting over a word, you know, the word that's going to do all that, that's going to pivot that particular idea.
Yeah, well, I'm often worrying about it at night, but I'm not lying down.
Good. Good. Well, we'll take a break from poetry for now to go to fiction, well, prose fiction. Janet Todd is the author of several works on Jane Austen, a biography of Aphra Behn, and books on Fanny Wollstonecraft and the Shelley Circle. A Man of Genius, set in London and Venice in the period following the Napoleonic Wars, is her first novel. I asked her, after all those works of non-fiction, how it felt to write fiction.
It felt absolutely wonderful. I always yearned to be a novelist. I think the novelist was always trying to get out. But somehow I fell into academics. It was a good day job, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed reading other people's works. But latterly, I was writing biographies. And although that is not fiction, it's the next step. It is about lives. It's about getting inside people, thinking about what they think, how they react to their environment. So I think I was eased back into what I always wanted to do.
And there's an element of your non-fiction work in this because your heroine, Anne, is a Gothic novelist.
Yes, she's a hack writer, though. I mean, she writes cheap Gothic novels. And I did become interested in those sort of women, sort of followers of Anne Radcliffe, but nothing like her level. Ones who wrote sort of the same story over and over again and had rather lurid woodcuts at the beginning of the novels. Those sort of women. Not all of them were women. A lot of men wrote them. But I did find when I was looking into Gothic fiction of this period, this is the sort of Regency period, that a lot of them were women. And they must have been making a very modest but definite living.
And The Man of Genius, it's called A Man of Genius. Yeah. The Man of Genius is Robert James. He's a very charismatic, very clever man, very envious of Byron. Is he based on a man who was around at that period of time?
No, he's not based on anybody in particular. I don't think I could base him on a real genius because in the end he fails. But I would say that since the last book I'd written was on the children of Mary Wollstonecraft and particularly their relationship with the poet Shelley. Shelley is obviously a genius, but his treatment of some of the women was not great. And I think I used a little bit the odd remark of his inside the book. But my point about my particular genius is somebody who does think he's that has the kind of egoism, the monstrous egoism of a person who thinks they're divinely inspired rather than simply writing and crafting and working through. What happens when that sort of man starts not to believe in himself or to worry that the inspiration is no longer there? And then I ask the question, of course, what happens to the person who loves that man when the idol, the icon, seems to have feet of clay, to mix metaphors?
Well, you talked about the treatment of women there, and this is a book as much about domestic violence as well. Did you do any research on that?
Well, as a woman, you can't not see it. It's everywhere. It's in all classes. If it's not physical violence, it can be psychological, it can be emotional, it can be all sorts. And I've always been interested in that because in the end, underneath problems between men and women, often there is that element of power play. And I've lived in a lot of other countries and I've seen it work out in different ways. And I think we're now working against it very much. And it's wonderful if we can control it as much as possible. But often there is a sort of power play in a relationship. And there is a sort of addiction to it, I find. And I imagine that's in both sexes. So I was trying to investigate that. So it's a relationship not straightforwardly of violence, though it is that, but one of mutual torment. I'm trying to think about the element of addiction to suffering, almost. The sense that I get from literature and from observation in a very long life, that one can be almost enthralled to one's own suffering and to feel that one is living on a slightly higher plane from those who are just going about their ordinary life. So I was trying to catch that in the relationship of Anne and Robert.
It is quite frustrating because Anne never really condemns him for the way he treats her and never forgives him. It's quite a difficult line to tread when you're writing, isn't it?
I think it is. I mean, what I also wanted to do is not be... I mean, I care about my characters. I didn't want to be too warm towards her because I wanted to see that from a damaged childhood, she was also damaged. And so she became a sort of stalker with him. After all, she pursues him when he tries to leave. And the kind of neediness that comes from such a lonely childhood, I wanted also to investigate that. She's also somebody who, through a strange relationship with her mother, is dominated by stories and other people's views, other people's memories. And so again, I wanted to suggest that once she's caught in a relationship like this, it's very hard for her to get out. And I suppose I feel that sometimes we tend to think that with a bit of antidepressant and a bit of therapy that people can get over what they've suffered. But I'm not sure that's always the case. And I think that with Anne, I'm trying to suggest that it isn't quite as easy as that. So if somebody might say, well, he's been mean to her, why doesn't she leave? I think it's not quite as simple as that.
And it's set during a very turbulent time. It's post-Napoleonic Wars. Yes. Why did you set it then?
Well, partly because of the idea of the man of genius. This is the period that really goes to town on this idea. The period is dominated by Napoleon, the great genius, and this idea of the great man who's special, who's above ordinary morality, is, I think, very much the creation of this period. It really wasn't there much before. And yeah, it's a bit like celebrity now. You know, they can live by different standards from the rest of us. So it mattered to me that it was this particular period. But it's also a period after great trouble. I mean, it's a bit like the 1940s. It's post-war. People are disillusioned. Those who believed in great political ideals no longer do so. And that's true of London, but it's also particularly true of Venice, which is, at this point, a conquered city. It's now a sort of almost a colony of Austria. So all that grandeur and pride in what Venice was has had to be on hold, and very much is becoming a tourist destination, but also still a place of secrecy, a place of surveillance and so on.
I love the image you paint of Venice because it is very beautiful and very captivating, but it's got these dark sides to it. The dark rooms, you say, it's a city that won't admit that it gets cold.
Mm. Well, I think that's true. I've discovered that myself. I first went there for any length of time in February. I've never been so cold in my life because it's damp and it's wet and underfoot it's miserable. And then it's hot and humid in the summer. But it's also magical, and I still think it is, despite being full of tourists, because it isn't all full, and there are still dark streets, there are still windy little passages. And I wanted to catch through my characters the way that they are both appalled and enthralled by the place. It is something that gets inside them, but they would always be, as I am always, an outsider there. I don't think you're ever quite there.
And the audiobook for this is being read by Miriam Margolyes. How wonderful.
I think it is wonderful. I think she is wonderful. We were in college at Newnham together, and we've been friends off and on all the time because I was out of the country a long time and we didn't meet then. But in latter years, I've come back and we've been friends again. I think she's absolutely marvellous. I think she reads brilliantly. But she's also a good, warm and lovely friend. And I'm very grateful to Newnham for that. They brought us together.
So what next for you now, Jan? Is there another novel on the way?
Well, in my mid-70s, I don't think I can suggest that I can write many, many, many more. But I do, I have started one. I've always been starting novels, but I have one that is set in the 1940s, another slightly strange period when people are becoming used to a period of semi-peace. I want to write about rather eccentric I like eccentric women from that period. So I think that would be my next one.
That's Jan Todd there talking about her debut novel, A Man of Genius. Jan also talking at the beginning of that interview, Rod Mangum, at your studio guest today, about how her non-fiction work influenced her fiction work. And I see, you know, you've written books about Dickens, Hardy, Emily Brontë and Henry Green. Have has their work fed into your work?
I don't think it has directly. Although, I suppose what all those writers have in common and what draws them to me more than anything else probably is the richness of their language. So that when I read Dickens, it's as much a language experience for me as anything else. And I'm reading the way he is planting, you know, the same images, the same figures of speech throughout the book, so that the whole thing is a kind of dazzling structure. It's not just a great story with fantastic characters, but also an extraordinary work of art.
Is that why you chose those writers to write about it?
Probably. I mean, Henry Green was kind of a no-brainer. He came first. He was the subject of my PhD, and he's an extraordinary, mesmerising writer. Very oblique and difficult to pin down. Very intense. The writing is very dense. And nobody had written what I thought was a halfway good book about him, so that there was a job to do there.
And Hardy and Emily Bronte also wrote poetry, but have you ever been tempted to write a novel?
It's interesting that Janet said she's always starting novels, I've had plenty of ideas, but never. Well, apart from anything else, never had the time to look forward to when I could spend, big chunks of time on such a long project. I've been writing short stories recently, but that's probably as far as it will go.
And you've written sequences, poetry sequences, poem sequences.
Yeah, I mean, that gives you a greater, more length, more structure, as it were. But they're very different kinds of composition, I think, fiction and poetry. In The Chance of a Storm book, there are prose poems, and there are a couple of texts which you could think of as fables, but they're not really modern fiction. There's a kind of out-of-time quality to them, it seems to me.
You're going to read from Chance of a Storm for us in just a moment, but we're listening to your second bit of music now, which is Bartok, music for strings and percussion. Why have you chosen this one?
I think Bartok, for me, is the greatest 20th century composer. He's the most revolutionary, the most experimental, I think, partly because of his rhythms and partly also because, as you'll hear in this movement from music for strings, percussion and celesta, although it's very daringly experimental, it's really modern and up-to-date, it's absolutely filled with snatches of folk song. So it's based on something very, very deeply traditional from the folk art of Hungary.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Our aspirations wrapped up in books.
You're listening to Bookmark with me, Mena Van Praagh, and Lee Chambers, and we're here with the poet Rod. And he's about to read from his new book of poetry, Chance of a Storm.
Thanks very much. I'm going to read a very short poem, which is actually something of a translation. And that's an important part of some of the things that I do include translation. And this one is actually an ancient Greek poem by Archilochus. And it's... of all the Greek poems I read when I was learning Greek at school, this is the one that I connected with most, and it's a fantasy, really, and it's very strange work. So this is my version of it. It's very much an adaptation, called After Archilochus. Nothing is out of this world, or beyond the pale, since Zeus found night in the blue of days, left the sun at a non-plus, made men forever twitchy. Now anything and everything springs from the box. So what if the beasts of the field leap in the sea like dolphins? The spouting waves are a charm to the ears, but not where the dolphins are, at rest in their mountain hideaway.
And you're going to read a prose poem, were you going to?
Yeah, and as I mentioned, half of the book consists of prose, so it seems appropriate to read at least one of those. And this is a prose poem about a painting, really, by Caravaggio, Caravaggio's Saint Jerome. And what drew me to this was the fact that, as with all of these well-known subjects, there are, you know, hundreds, thousands of paintings of Saint Jerome in the world. The painter has to get a model, get some props into the studio, start with what's around him, and then transform it into something else entirely. And this is my kind of speculation about Caravaggio Saint Jerome. It's called The Commission. Paid for by a knight of St. John, Caravaggio's Saint Jerome was first transmitted onto canvas in Malta, remaining there ever since. The knights clung to the island for nearly 300 years as sea traffic controllers, their purpose to stop the pilgrim ships vanishing off the radar. The geography and history of the Christian world registered as persistent blips until yesterday, and even now they roll across the screen subliminally as ghost ships. Everything was balanced on the pivot of the night's limpet shell endurance, just as the orbit of holy scripture round the earth, above the mottled skin of continents, glittering seas, cloud rack, was encompassed by the heel of Jerome's writing hand. Caravaggio's Jerome has almost undressed without noticing, from sheer concentration. Or he has sloughed the trademark red robes to expose the body of the sitter, which was that of an aging man inured to physical labour. The well-shaped white torso, the sunburned head and hands, look like they came from the nearest boat. They do not take kindly to acts of writing. The hands belong to a fisher of fish heaving on his nets, not to a fisher of men alighting on his words. They encase the inkpot as if it would break. They nurse the pen as if it would fly away. Jerome did not scry the history slipping aside from the pen's advance and coiling and churning like the wake of a slaver's galley, mingling the ink of hope with all blood types. But for hours he would chain his mind to the task. The sitter had never learned the correct movement of fingers, or how to push the quill to begin its seismic dance. For him, the roll of vellum was a dead calm, a wide gulf where mind would not stir, where landfall was not even the brush filament of an idea.
That's lovely. Thank you. I'm just wondering, that's a prose poem there. I mean, it all comes down to labels. What's the difference between a prose poem and flash fiction?
And what?
Flash fiction.
Flash fiction. I don't even know what flash fiction is.
Well, it's a sort of truncated form of fiction. But I'm guessing a prose poem. Flash fiction normally seems to have a beginning, a middle and an end. And I suppose a prose poem can be more about a moment or a thought. Is that what you were trying to capture there?
Yeah, it's a meditation, really. You're absolutely right. It's a thought about a painting. It's a kind of a process of thinking that's arisen from an experience of just looking at a painting. So it's exploring an object, really, visually and mentally.
And that's from the collection Chance of a Storm. When you put together a collection and you give it a title, it all has to be cohesive, does it? How do you work? Do you do the poems first and think, yeah, there's a theme there? Or do you think, you know, I want to write about this, therefore I'm going to write poems around this theme? Or is it more organic than that?
Well, a lot of these poems were published initially in little chapbooks, little pamphlets, in groups, therefore. And they had their own titles. And I retained one of those titles for a group of poems called Paris by Helen. They were poems that were all written in Paris, although the title Paris by Helen tells you it's about, in some ways, about the Iliad and the Odyssey and the fallout from that. And the poems are all about war, effectively, and conflict. Because when I was writing them in Paris, I was tuning into the radio and the reports of a lot of conflicts all over the world, which is still ongoing. So I retained some of the titles, but not all of them. And then about three quarters of the way through composing Chance of a Storm, I hit on this title and thought, actually, I'd really like to have this title, partly because the image on the front cover is by Mark Atkins of a place called Grimspound, which I'm writing a long work about. And that was originally going to be in this book, but I didn't finish it in time. So I've still got the cover image and I've still got the title, but I haven't got Grimspound. But I happened upon, isn't it strange? I happened upon a sequence of four poems at the end, which I've called Storm Songs, just in the nick of time before I had to submit the book.
Well, you talked about the cover of your book, your front cover there. We'll come back to you in a moment, Rob. But as we're talking about books, it's a good time to hear from Edward Cheese. Edward is the conservator of manuscripts and printed works at the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge. When I met him at the museum, I asked him to tell me more about his work.
My role is to look after the physical well-being of all the material in our department. So that can range from the 10,000 rare printed books in the Founders Library to beautiful medieval and Renaissance illuminated manuscripts, cuttings of pictures from manuscripts which have been collected over the years, and archival collections of authors' autographed manuscripts and composers' works.
So there's some very rare and precious works there. It must be a privilege for you to spend so much time with them.
Yes, privilege is absolutely the right word. I feel that very strongly. I get to see it firsthand and handle things that other people see behind bulletproof glass, and that is an enormous privilege.
Is it a bit frightening as well, because these are such precious artefacts?
It can be, yes. I think the way to think of it is put all the financial value out of your mind before you start. You have to approach your work in a very calm fashion, in a good frame of mind, so you're concentrating absolutely, and then become absorbed in the material. It's such wonderful material that that's not difficult.
So what kind of condition are the books in when they come to you?
It depends, really. If we have a request for something going out on loan, usually I have a look. Mostly the manuscripts are in good condition, but we check anyway to make sure everything's in good condition, so it's safe before it goes on display. At other times, books come to conservation because they're in need of repair. They're unlike any other part of a museum collection. You can walk through the Fitzwilliam and you can see cases of china cups, beautiful drinking glasses, you can see dresses and shoes, you can see sculpture, lots of paintings hanging on the wall. And all those museum objects are fine because they're sitting in a glass case. Nobody touches them. Yet the same people who would never dream of using those coffee cups to test if they still hold coffee and what it tastes like coming out of them can come in and see books which are far, far older, and they want to use them. Books are a mechanical object. They've got to flex, they've got to open. So that's quite a big part of my job, is to make sure that, yes, the historic bindings are preserved as much as possible, but also that people can use them, because wear and tear over hundreds of years does build up and you get damaged that way. So it's a matter of balancing the historical significance of the binding with sensitive repair so that we can let people see this material.
So it's most of the damage that's done to the books and manuscripts you deal with, is most of that down to wear and tear?
Of course we always make sure the books are handled carefully, everybody is trained in how to use them, but yes, any mechanical wear eventually breaks things down. And leather, which covers the great majority of our books, after a couple of hundred years generally starts to break down anyway. It's chemically unsound, starts to degrade. So we have in the Founders Library many books bound for Viscount Fitzwilliam. We know he commissioned them, we know who bound them. Sometimes there are even records of the cost he paid. That's lovely to have that, but at the same time, all those beautiful gold tool bindings, a lot of them are made on calfskin, which is falling apart under its own chemical nature. It's very acidic leather, and it's starting to fall to pieces. So again, we've got the balance of how do we preserve, how far do we repair so that these books can be used.
So the binding might be deteriorating, as you mentioned there. What other problems might you be dealing with?
We have problems of light and fluctuating humidity, which all museum collections have to deal with, particularly with illustrated books with colour plates and manuscripts with beautiful illuminated pages. We don't want to expose them too much to the light, because light can be damaging. Yes, we want to look at them, but we want to look at them in safe conditions. So when the light is lower, we've got rid of all the UV as far as possible, so that they can be kept in good condition. The reason why a lot of these plates and the beautiful illuminations have survived so well is that a book spends most of its life shut on the shelf, so the colours are preserved really beautifully. We want to be able to appreciate that.
If a book comes to you, it's got a damaged cover, maybe a spine that's damaged, the page is deteriorating a little. What do you do?
That depends very much. It's always on a case-by-case basis. In my job, there's no such thing as a standard case. So in recent project I've been working on, a large medieval encyclopedia, that came to us in a rather plain 18th century binding, not very well put together actually. It's a parchment manuscript from the early 15th century in an 18th century binding. Parchment manuscripts were bound in a particular way when they're originally made, with very little adhesive so that they flexed well. By the 18th century the original binding had gone, and somebody put it in a gold-tooled spine to look good on the shelf, really. Lots of glue on the spine, covering up lots and lots of damage in the spine folds. It's one of those cases where we debated quite a lot about what we should do. Should we keep the 18th century binding, which was actually causing damage to the wonderful manuscript inside? And actually it didn't open very well, so people couldn't see the manuscript easily. Some of the marginal decoration was invisible, simply because the book wouldn't flex in the spine, so much glue on the structure. In that case, we felt that the significance of the manuscript was such, and the binding not as important, that we would remove the 18th century binding, which we keep. We keep everything that goes with the book, so that we could then conserve the pages individually. So 370 leaves, all conserved, repaired, all the glue removed, flattened out carefully where there was damage. And then we've bound that in a binding which is based on a 15th century model, so we have a book which opens beautifully and people can enjoy.
And that's this big book that I'm sitting next to now.
Yes.
How long did that take you to do?
It's taken about 200 hours, yes, of work. That's not all at once, it's spread over a year. So taking off the glue, then going through and repairing all the broken folds of the spine. Yes, that takes a lot of work, and then letting the manuscript settle before starting to put the new structure on, the new sewing, the new boards in a traditional manner.
That's 200 hours. You must be a very patient man.
Patience does play a part in this job, yes. If you don't have patience, it's not really a very good profession to be in. Yes, you have to be patient. The first repair has to be as good as the 100th repair, as good as the 300th repair. You've got to be in a good place in your mind, very calm, focused work.
You see yourself as conserving rather than restoring. You're not trying to get this book back to what it was when it was originally published or produced. You're trying to get it back to the best it can be.
It's a very interesting question, that there's a sort of grey area between conservation and restoration. Conservation, on the one hand, we don't want to interfere with something too much, but actually it's broken, so we do a certain amount of repair. Restoration has the sense of wanting to make something perfect. This binding is informed by bindings of the 15th century that we know have survived and worked well, sound conservation principles in that structure, but it's not trying to be anything other than it is, a modern binding that preserves this manuscript. So all my repairs are made so that they blend in with the manuscript, but if you look closely you can see that they're repairs, and all the work is reversible. You can remove my repair patches, and if you snip through the sewing threads, somebody in the future can take the sections out of that book and get back to something which they can do what they will with. Put it in a different binding if that's what they decide to do.
And of course there's lots of talk now about the book being dead, the printed word being dead. You're dealing very much with that. Do you have an opinion on that?
Yes, I do. A strong opinion, yes. I think Kindles and digital text are wonderful for certain things, but I think we're a long, long way away from the death of the traditional book. People still have a love of something you can hold in your hand. It's a very personal relationship. And for me, that's partly why I came into book conservation particularly, because it means so much to me that you can have in your hand a book which somebody held in their hand 500 years ago. And it's a very, very close relationship across the centuries that way.
Well, you spent 200 hours with this book. You must have a very personal relationship. You must literally know it inside out.
Yes, I do know it rather well. It's fascinating what you can find. When we took off the 18th century binding, we start to find fragments of the original medieval sewing thread. And we can see the way the book was made up. We can see joins in the parchment which we hadn't suspected were there before. It's been a fascinating journey, and this is part of the work of conservation, to bring out all these different histories in the book.
And how did you come into book conservation? What was your route into this?
Initially, I was an English literary student, but I'd always wanted to do something that was practical as well as testing intellectual skills. Always enjoyed repairing things, and then after I'd done my academic qualifications, I was lucky enough to get a place on a postgraduate diploma course and spent 2 years training in book conservation before coming to Cambridge and working with well-known experts in the field. Again, another great privilege to be able to work with them, learn from them.
So what inspired you to do the book conservation course?
My love of books, from both the practical, physical aspect of this is how a binding is made, this is how it works, it's a wonderful way of presenting text, and also from the literary aspect as well. I'm fascinated by the text as well.
And over the years, has there been one book that you've worked on that's been your favourite, that you're particularly pleased with?
They all have a special place. It's like asking, what's your favourite piece of music? It depends on the mood. All of them have something special to offer. There's no job which is exactly the same as the one before it, and that's a great thing about it.
There's a man who loves his job. That's Edward Cheese, conservator of manuscripts and printed works at the Fitzwilliam Museum. It did strike me, listening to that, Rod Mangum, that he was talking about the different layers underneath a book, that you peel it away and you get something from the century before, and then you peel that away, you get something from the century before that. Do you feel that with language? Because you must pore, and we refer to this, pore over a single word, that you are unpeeling bit by bit, like an onion, each particular meaning of that word as it goes, well, perhaps down through time.
That would be great. if the work...
You could just agree. If
no,
you
know. No. That would be a great achievement. And certainly it is an ambition, in the sense that some critics have picked up on the fact that in the most recent book, Chance of a Storm, there are sort of seeded here and there quotations from earlier works, which are, you know, drawing on the earlier works, arguments or comments on particular issues, and I kind of, you know, folded them into what I've been writing, so that every word you use has a history, but of course, to be aware of that history all the time with every word that you use would be completely overwhelming. But so some words need to be weighted differently than others, I suppose. But I think it's a wonderful thing if you can get a poetry which is constantly aware of and drawing on that history, not with every word, but with sort of key words, shall we say, here and there.
Is it more obvious to you when you're working with translations? Because then you are working with interpretations of words.
Well, just as a fact, I suppose, yes. But no, when you're composing your own work, then therefore you're the one who's responsible for making the decision for which word you use and how you use it.
And we haven't talked about sculpture yet, because, yes, you're curator of the sculpture exhibition at Jesus College. And sculpture, you refer to sculpture in your work as well. So you obviously have a love of sculpture.
Absolutely. I've had this job now for, let's say, as curator of works of art at Jesus College for 14 years, and it's the best job in college. And I get to do the main organising for a biennial sculpture exhibition, which people in Cambridge might have heard of, called Sculpture in the Close, which is all contemporary sculpture. And to be able to kind of draw together an exhibition like that and be responsible for setting out is fantastic, because sculpture is, you know, it's difficult to ignore sculpture. Even if you've got a great painting on the wall, if the painting's on the wall and you live in the rooms where the paintings are, it's easy for people to ignore them, you know, for one day, two days, 7 days a week. If you've got to walk around a sculpture, it's a bit different. And I think sculpture sort of collaborates with us in the spaces in which we live. And there's a kind of physical discussion going on with a sculpture all the time. And it's much more difficult to ignore.
And also on your CV, although sadly defunct, you were telling me, Cambridge Conference of Contemporary Poetry that you used to organise, but that's no longer around.
No, I mean, I was just one of, started off with many organisers and dwindled down to two and then dwindled away. But it lasted for about 10 years and was an annual event. It was a great thing. And we brought poets from certainly all over Europe and occasionally further afield. And it was all cutting-edge material, and was a tremendous event. But I think these things die a natural death, and I think if you're organising what seems to you the most important poetry event in a place like Cambridge for several years, then after a while you have to make way to the next generation. And there are now younger poets who are organising fantastic readings in Cambridge, and that's how it should be.
It does seem to me that poetry is on the up. Would you agree with that?
That's great to hear. I mean, I always think it's on the up, but then I can't see it from the outside, as it were.
It seems to me that younger people are connecting with it more. That's poets like Kate Tempest, you know, certainly have a following with an age group that perhaps wouldn't have been following poetry before. I'm talking about teenagers, late teenagers.
Right, and it's possible to access poetry, as we say nowadays, and sort of get access to as much poetry as you like very quickly on the web. And a lot of poetry is being written more or less for the web and engaged with on the web. Outside of the printed page, which is sad in a way, but at least it's there is a kind of community there.
So what next for you, Rod?
In what sense?
In writing sense.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm continuing to write more poems and more prose. As I said, there are a couple of texts in Chance of a Storm which are almost stories. I've called them fables. They're sort of modernist fables. And I'm writing more of those, and they're slightly longer, and that seems to be happening, so I'm going with that for the time being.
No novel. All these novels you've started, will we ever see one?
I didn't say I'd started the novel.
No.
It was Janet who started the novel. No, I just had ideas for novels.
Oh, ideas for novels. Oh, well, it's been lovely to talk to you. A Chance of a Storm is published by Carcanet. And out now, well worth a read. Do stay with us next week, or the next show rather, in 2 weeks' time. Our studio guest will be crime writer Jill Peyton Walsh, and we'll also be talking to Harry Sidebottom about Blood and Steel, which is the second book in the Throne of the Caesars series. If you'd like to listen to any of the old bookmarks, then go to the Cambridge 105 website, which is cambridge105.fm, and all the shows right from the beginning, from about 3 years ago, they're all up there waiting for you to listen to them. We're going to sign out now, Rod, with your last piece of music, which is the Stefani.
Yep, Agostino Stefani. It's from his opera Niobe. And the reason I've chosen this is because actually most of the music I listen to is medieval and Renaissance music, because it's the sound world of those times is strange to us now. I mean, I think we've got so used to the great works of art and the literature such as Shakespeare from that period that it's so familiar it's become almost part of our world. But there's a difference, I think, in the sound world of that time. It still sounds strange. This is an aria which is about sung by Amphion in the opera Niobe, and he's a king who is an artist whose music is so powerful it can move the physical world. And this aria is about being in tune with the spheres, with the celestial bodies. And you can hear in the continuous movement of the strings, you can almost see the rotating of those spheres.